Well, although Chumash Bayikra begins this week, we turn our attention in our Shir to matters of Purim, within which we are in a striking distance, and certainly in keeping with our tradition that when it comes to Purim, preparation time should be commensurate with recovery time. So it's a perfect time to begin. And we begin this evening by taking a look at Megillas Esther, which we have been steadily going through one perek per year, with the commentary of Yosef Lekach, the great Rabbi Elezer Ashkenazi, the author of the Maase Hashem on the Chumash, and the classic Yosef Lekach on the Megillah. If by mistake you brought a Chumash Shemos, Esther's in the back. Otherwise, we'll follow along pasuk by pasuk. And we find ourselves this year in a Perek Vav of the Megillah. And it's certainly fair to say that Perek Vav, chapter 6, is a turning point within the Megillah. Haman's decree is out. Jewish people have involved themselves in their tshuva, in their fasting, and so on. We've had the first of the feasts. I mean, Esther has already approached Ahasuerush in Perek Hay. And then Perek Vav begins, Balayla Hahu Nododosh Nas HaMelech. That night, the sleep of the king was agitated, was disturbed. And there is a well-known comment of the Gemara, which indicates just how much of a turning point this is, because not only was the Melech Ahasuerush's sleep disturbed, but so too, so to speak, was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's sleep. That is to say, it is referred to as sleep in the sense when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is inactive, and he's waiting for the Jewish people to act. Once they do, so he becomes more active, and therefore Nododosh Nas Malko Shel Olam. Some people have a minhag to read these words a little louder and emphasize the word HaMelech. As Rav Yehuda Edel of Slonim, in his Perush Iye Hayam on Agodas HaShas, explains the basis for the drash shem, and there needs to be some type of basis beyond the fact that it says the word HaMelech, for although some have a tradition that the word HaMelech always refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the Gemara makes specific mention of this instance, not earlier and not later. And the basis of the drasha, says the Iye Hayam, is the word nodada, because the root of the word is yud dalet hay, to move or to be agitated. But there doesn't need to be two dalets here. It would be sufficient to say nada, as is more in keeping with the norm. The fact that the root letter, the core root letter, is doubled over, nadada, two dalets, tell us that there is a duality to this agitation. That is to say, not only Ahasuerush's sleep was disturbed, but also HaKadosh Baruch Hu's, as the Gemara says. And returning to the realms of Pshat, which is the way in which the Yosef Lekach explains the Perek, we need to ask a few questions. And let us begin by reading the Pasuk in full. Balayla hahu nododosh nas HaMelech. On that night, the king's sleep was disturbed. Vayomer lahavi sefer zichronos divrei hayomim vayu nikraim lifnei HaMelech. And he asks for the chronicles of history to be brought to him. And they were read before him. And let us ask some basic questions. Firstly, al derech hapshat, why is the king so agitated? He's a Ahasuerush, everything seems to be going well. What's disturbing him? That's the first question. Why nododosh nas HaMelech? Secondly, as an antidote to his inability to fall asleep, he calls for the history of Persia. And we normally understand that he, if as it's read to him, he'll nod off. Not nodded off, but nod off. And that's the answer to his sleep problems. But it's very interesting that the thing should most put Ahasuerush to sleep is his own history. As far as we're concerned, Ahasuerush should probably find the history of his kingdom the most riveting and exciting book in existence. It should keep him up all night. So why is it that of all things, I mean, there's a lot of people that could be insulted when he says, I couldn't sleep last night, and then I read about you, and then I dozed off in no time. So how is the solution to be reading this book? And thirdly, as we are trying to be medactic in the psukim, we've said in our free translation that he asks for the Book of History, for the Book of Chronicles to be brought. This is not the first time that we have met this Sefer. Important events are inscribed in a book which is called Sefer Divrei Hayamim. For example, the plot with Bigson and Teresh at the end of Perek Beis, they were found out, they were executed, and it was written in Sefer Divrei Hayamim Asher Lachashverosh. So the book is called Divrei Hayamim. Here, it seems to have a different title, or perhaps a broader title, because it's called Sefer HaZichronos Divrei Hayomim, the Book of Remembrances, the Book of Chronicles. What is the difference between Sefer HaZichronos Divrei Hayomim and the normal book Divrei Hayomim? Why are there two? And these questions form the background of the explanation of something which is quite fascinating that's about to happen. To appreciate why Ahasuerus couldn't sleep that night, we need to recall what had happened that day. That day was the first of Esther's feasts. Now, it's very mysterious. She turns up unannounced, itself a bold and dangerous move, and she asks for a feast, and Ahasuerus provides. And then at the feast, he asks her what she wants, and she says she'll tell him tomorrow. There's nothing that's going to ruin Ahasuerus' sleep than trying to work out what it is that Esther wants. That's why he can't sleep. He's so wound up here because, on the one hand, it's got to be something big, because he knows that Esther has risked her life in order to ask for whatever this is. Everyone knows you cannot come to the king unannounced. You're risking your life, which she did. It has to be a big request. But she hasn't mentioned what it is. Well, what could it be? Generally speaking, a person, if they have a request, first and foremost, it may be for themselves. But as Ahasuerus realizes that Esther wants for nothing, there can't be anything that she could possibly want. She's the queen. She is in the highest position for any woman, essentially, in the entire world, in his entire kingdom. So there's nothing that she's lacking. So her request, it can't be for her. Well, who else could it be for? Perhaps for her people. She's never told him who her people are, and as far as he's concerned, never will, and he's given up on that, which means it's got to be for someone else. But who could that person be? Well, Ahasuerus realizes that there's only one person that somehow Esther is connected to, and that is Mordechai. When Mordechai knows things, Esther knows things. The plot of Bigson and Teresh that was revealed, it was discovered by Mordechai, told to Esther, and Esther told the king in Mordechai's name. So although, and we may wonder, how can Ahasuerus not put two and two together and realize that if Esther is so closely connected to Mordechai, who's the most Jewish person in the world, then perhaps she is somewhat Jewish herself. That seems to elude him for reasons not entirely clear, but he does know that Esther and Mordechai is someone that Esther is close to. And therefore, Ahasuerus reasons her request, it's big, it's not for her, it's got to be for Mordechai. She is going to ask him to do something for Mordechai. But the question is, what might she ask him? Is there anything that Mordechai deserves? And this leads him back to the episode of Bigson and Teresh, because Mordechai is the one who uncovered the plot, and presumably, therefore, Esther wants Mordechai to receive something big in recognition of having done that. And that's why Ahasuerus wants to know what happened at the time. He's forgotten. This is actually a good while back. He's forgotten. did he ever close his account with Mordechai? Did he ever reward Mordechai? If so, maybe he needs to think further. But if not, then it will certainly be about that. And therefore, he calls for a book. The book is not to cause him to doze off to sleep. The book is to give him the answer to what he's looking for, namely to find out if Mordechai was ever rewarded for his service to Ahasuerus. And that's why the book that he calls for is not the Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim recounts everything in full. He doesn't need to hear the whole story. He knows the whole story. Rather, he calls for a shorter work that he keeps. And that's called Sefer HaZichronos Divrei Hayamim, the remembrances, almost like the accounts of Divrei Hayamim. It's not the whole history, but rather it's the bottom line, who was dealt with, who was rewarded, who was punished, who was recognized, who was banished. That's the Sefer HaZichronos. And in fact, again, if we are medactic in the way we read the psukim, we can see that this book is quite different than the Divrei Hayamim. Not only is it shorter, but it really is a record of the results. And the way that we see that is because Pasuk Beis reads, Vayimatzei Kasuv, it was found written, Asher Higid Mordechai Abigsana Vaseres, that Mordechai told, revealed about Bigtan and Teresh, Shnei Seresei HaMelech, Mishamei Asav, Asher Bikshulish Lach Yad Bamelech Achashverosh, that he told about what they were trying to do. Now, what's very interesting is the way that that episode is recounted here is not the way it's recounted in the Megillah in real time, so to speak. Because when Perek Beis tells us the story, it tells us the events as they unfolded. It starts with Bigson and Teresh. I mean, that's how that Mordechai doesn't enter the picture until they've started. That they had this plot, and then Mordechai heard, and then he told Achashverosh about it. Here, it's reversed. The way that it's recorded is not Bigthan and Teresh tried to kill the king and then Mordechai told him about it, but rather it's recorded as Mordechai told the king what Bigthan and Teresh were going to do. It starts at the end because that's the way the Sefer HaZichronos works. It cuts to the chase. It gets to the bottom line. It's about Mordechai and that's why it's abbreviated in that way. And interestingly, this gives us new insight into the opening words of Pasuk Beis, which read, Vayimatzei Kasuv, it was found written. The reason why the Pasuk says it was found written is because Achashverosh was looking for it. They didn't open up at the beginning and keep on reading and then all of a sudden this came out. He was looking for the episode of Mordechai and they found it. And when they found it, it was written that Mordechai had done this thing. And then Achashverosh asks, did anything ever come of it? Which is Pasuk Gimel. And that's where Achashverosh asks, Vayom HaMelech, Mana Asar, what was done? Yikar Ugedula, honor or greatness, Lemordechai Azeh. And as the Vilna Gaon explains, Yikar and Gedula, I mean, as the name suggests, but important to realize, that there are really two ways that the king could reward someone for a favor done to him. One is yikar, and one is gedula. That is to say, yikar is a display of honor. That's one type of reward. Gedula, greatness, some type of position, some type of territory, or to increase his standing or his assets. And Achashverosh asks, were either of those two things done to Mordechai? Was he given yikar, honor, or gedula, was some type of greatness or position bestowed upon him? And they said, no, lo na'asa imo davar, nothing was done. And now Achashverosh, in his estimation, knows what Esther wants. Nothing ever was given to Mordechai. She's connected to Mordechai. She's going to ask for a big favor, and she doesn't need it herself. It's going to be for Mordechai's sake. As far as Achashverosh is concerned, case closed. It's all sorted out. Achashverosh has solved yet another mystery. Now, in the meanwhile, Haman is outside. And why is he outside? We have to remind ourselves that Haman actually has had a very busy day. and he will have yet another busy day, because ever since the yesterday's feast, when he came back on top of the world, he told his wife and his advisors and his friends that he's happy with everything except for Mordechai. They advised him to build a gallows and in the morning to go and tell Ahasuerus to hang Mordechai on that gallows. The previous perek ends by Mordechai making the gallows, and it's 50 amas tall, which is a lot. That's a lot of work, and it's in the dark. So that's the first thing he's been doing recently. He's been building a gallows. Then he doesn't go home. He goes to Ahasuerus' palace. And that already is more than what his advisors told him to do. They said, tomorrow morning, get there first thing in the morning, and you'll have the king's ear first. But Zrizi Makdimim, he doesn't wait till first thing in the morning. He's there in the middle of the night, just to make sure. So his advisors told him to go Hashkama, but he's doing a Mishmar, because he's there all night. Much, much earlier than he needs to be for his own request, but just on time for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's purposes, because Ahasuerus senses that someone's there, which is itself quite interesting. Ahasuerus himself, is he half asleep? Where is he? I mean, he notices that someone's there, even though the Pasuk says that Haman was in the outer courtyard. Ahasuerus, paranoid as ever, if anyone's on the premises, he'll sense it. He knows. And therefore, Pasuk Dalet reads, Vayomer Melech, Bibachatzer, who's in the courtyard? It's Haman. The Haman Vala Chatzabis Amelech Achitzona, he's already there in the middle of the night. Leimor Lamelech, Lislosis Mordechai Ala Eitz, Asher Heichin Lo. To tell the king to hang Mordechai on the gallows, Asher Hi Heichin Lo, as the Gemara says, the pshat is that he prepared for him, but there's a lot of hymns in the pasuk, there's a lot of pronouns. In the end, he prepared it for himself, lo heichin, but he doesn't know that yet. As far as he's concerned, he has prepared it for Mordechai. Okay, now, when the king hears that Haman is there, they say, Haman is there, vayoma melech yavo, vayavo Haman. Now, what's fascinating is, how does Ahasuerus figure that Haman fits into this picture? Because it's clear to him that Haman is part of the picture. He doesn't know why, but he knows that it is so. And the reason why is because Esther, in her feasts, which is clearly to give some type of reward to Mordechai, has invited one other person to those feasts, Haman. Because Ahasuerus has determined that the goal of these feasts is in order to reward Mordechai, if she has invited Haman to those feasts, that means somehow she is also in conjunction with Haman, between the two of them, will get this result to give greatness to Mordechai. Why does Haman want to give greatness to Mordechai? Ahasuerus doesn't know, but he knows that he does. What else would he be doing in Esther's feasts, which are geared towards that goal? And therefore, Ahasuerus wants to preempt Esther. That's really what this request is about. When he asks Haman, what should one do to someone that the king wishes to honor? The reason why he says that is because he wants to already have settled the account with Mordechai before the next feast. He doesn't want to wait to hear what Esther is asking for Mordechai. He wants to give the reward himself, so that when Esther comes and says, you know, nothing ever happened with Mordechai, which he is convinced that she will say that, he will say, oh, well, you know, it's very interesting, it's just this morning, I rewarded Mordechai. He wants to have been yotze, already rewarding Mordechai before the feast comes. And that's very interesting because it gives a very different atmosphere to Ahasuerus' question to Esther in the second feast, as opposed to the first feast. In the first feast, he has no idea what she wants. And he asks, what do you want? And she doesn't know, and he has no idea. By the time the second feast comes along, in his estimation, he already knows the answer to her question and has already dealt with it. So on day two, he's asking her in a much more knowing way, what can I do for you? Already anticipating what he thinks is the answer to reward Mordechai. Little did he know, she wants something else entirely. So that's a surprise all round in the second feast. But in the meanwhile, Ahasuerus asks this question to Haman because he wants Haman to fix the reward for Mordechai. And now we find ourselves in a very interesting situation because Ahasuerus doesn't say who the person is. He just asked in a very open-ended way, what to do? Ma la'asos ba'ish asher ha'melech chafetz bikaro. Why does he not say who it is? Well, from Ahasuerus' point of view, he doesn't really do that much for Mordechai. And therefore, because he's convinced that Haman wants to reward Mordechai, that's why he's at the feast, he doesn't want to say it's Mordechai because he's worried that Haman, as soon as he knows that it's Mordechai, will ask for a great deal. Little does he know that had he mentioned that it's for Mordechai, Haman would have given a much more diminished response. In the event, he doesn't say either way, which means Haman thinks he's talking about him. So this is the mix as he asks his question. And we can see that Ahasuerus doesn't really want to give that much to Mordechai because his question to Haman is, in Pasuk Vav, Ma la'asos ba'ish asher ha'melech chafetz bikaro. What should one do to someone that the king wishes to honor? Interestingly, there are two possibilities for reward, as we saw earlier in the perek. There's Yakar and Gedula. Of those two, Ahasuerus, he chooses one of them. He doesn't want to give Mordechai Yakar and Gedula. He prefers to give him Yakar. It's cheaper. And therefore, he minimizes even what he's offering. And of course, Esther can't complain and say, well, you only gave him Yakar, what about some Gedula? So he really wants to economize on the reward that he's giving to Mordechai and just scales it down to Yakar. Ironically, in doing so, says Yosef Lekach, in mentioning only Yakar and not Gedula, Ahasuerus further gave Haman to understand that he was talking about Haman. And the reason why is because Haman is second in command. He is the Mishnah Lamela. That means he is the only person that you cannot give Gedula to because he is already as great as he can be without actually usurping the king. And therefore, everyone knows that if the king wants to reward someone, he should offer either honor and greatness. But if he only mentions honor, says Haman, it's got to be me. I can always do with some more kavod, but I can't get any greater. And that's why if he's only offering yakar, it's got to be me. And that's why Haman says, who would he want to honor more than me? Now, where are we? Ahasuerus doesn't want Haman to know that he's thinking about Mordechai. Haman thinks Ahasuerus is talking about him, Haman. And then something very interesting happens. And that is in Pasuk Zion, and it's an entire Pasuk which reads as follows. Vayomer Haman el HaMelech. Haman said to the king, Ish asher HaMelech chafetz bikaro. That is the entire pasuk. A man that the king wishes to honor. In the next pasuk, he'll already say what it is, bring the horse and the clothing and all of that. But in the meanwhile, there's this one pasuk. A man that the king wishes to honor. And actually, this pasuk seems somewhat repetitious because it's in the question. The question was, what to do for a man that the king wishes to honor? If the question is out, then the answer is, well, I would say you should bring the horse and the clothing. Why does Haman preface his answer by repeating the question or repeating the matter at hand? Ish asher hamelech hafetz bikaro. The reason why, says Yosef Lekach, is that Haman, he thinks that it's him. But he'd like to try and find out. Namely, he wants to kind of elicit some type of reaction. He thinks that the king is really talking about him, but the king hasn't mentioned him by name. And therefore, he very deliberately goes over those words, Ish, a man, that the king wishes that he's looking for kind of a glint of recognition from Ahasuerus, some type of corroboration that it really is him. So he repeats those words in order to get at some signal from the Ahasuerus that, right, and we mean me. Ahasuerus, in the meanwhile, isn't giving anything away for his reasons, because he doesn't want Haman to know that he's talking about Mordechai, and therefore he stonewalls, and Haman realizes he's not getting anywhere just repeating. Ahasuerus isn't giving anything away, but he proceeds because he's quite sure that it's him anyway. But he thought it was worth a try, and that's what Pasuk Zion is all about. Okay, so what is the reward? So let's see Pasuk Ches. Yavilu v'shmalchus, let them bring royal garments, asher lo vashpo ha-melech, that the king wore, v'sus asher rechav alav ha-melech, and the horse that the king has ridden on, v'ashenitan keser malchus b'rosho, that the crown has been put on his head. So Haman here, in Pasuk Ches, in the beginning of his answer, mentions three things: the clothing, the horse, and the crown. Interestingly, in Pasuk Tes, one of those gets dropped from the equation. Pasuk Tes says, V'nason halavush v'hasus, and they should give the clothing and the horse to one of the king's attendants, and they should dress him and parade him through the city. And the question, of course, is, what happened to the crown? Originally, clothing, horse, and crown. But as he proceeds, it's just the clothing and the horse. Where did the crown go? Well, Rashi says that here Ahasuerus did react. Meaning, one can only go so far, even with the king. And even if it's someone that the king wishes to honor. Which means that Haman, he bit off a bit more than he could chew. He starts with the clothing, very nice. And then the royal horse, very nice. And then the royal crown, not very nice. At that point, Ahasuerus' face kind of clouded over, and Haman realized he had overstepped the mark. Even for someone that the king wants to honor, do not mention the crown. And therefore that got dropped from the program, and it's just about the clothing and the horse. That is how Rashi explains. So there are some facial cues coming from Ahasuerus, not about who it's about, but one thing's for sure, the crown is out. However, the Yosef Lekach explains, again, al derech ha-pshat, that the truth is that the crown was never part of the equation. So what's interesting, again, if we look at Haman's words, it says, yavil v'shmachus, let them bring royal clothing, v'sus asher rechav alav ha-melech, and the horse that the king has ridden on, v'asher nitan kesa malchus b'rosho, and that the royal crown was put on his head. But if it's a third thing, then just like the others, it should have said v'keser asheni tana v'rosho, let them bring the clothing, let them bring the horse, and let them bring the crown. But he doesn't say v'keser. He says v'asher nitan keser malchus al rosho. So what role is the crown playing within this program? And that's why Yosef Lekach says that actually Haman is only ever from the outset talking about royal clothing and the horse. So how does the crown fit in? Because what he's saying is that the horse that they should choose should be a special horse. Special in what way? This is the horse that the king rode on the day that the crown was put on his head. In other words, this is the coronation day horse. That's as good as it gets. And therefore, it was only ever about the clothing and the horse, but the horse that the king wore on the day that he was crowned. Once he's established which horse it is, he doesn't need to mention the crown again. But rather, they should ride him on the horse of which we spoke, the horse from the coronation day. Aha. And that is Haman's answer. Now, Ahasuerus is quite happy with this, because, again, in his estimation, this will be the answer to what's going to happen to Mordechai, and he's gotten off relatively lightly. And therefore, he says to Haman in Pasuk Yud, "Vayomer Melech Haman, Maher, kach ezalvush v'asasus kasher dibarta, hurry, do this quickly." Why does he want Haman to do it quickly? Because he wants it all to be over with before they come to the second feast. He doesn't want Haman to say, "Well, actually, it's Mordechai. Please see to it sometime," because then Haman will dilly-dally So that Mordechai, nothing's happened to Mordechai by the second feast. He wants this to be over. He wants Mordechai to be fully rewarded by the time they come to the second feast. And therefore he tells Haman to hurry up. And in fact, he tells Haman to do everything. As he says, Kachas al vush besasus, because he doesn't even want to get other people involved. As soon as there's other attendants, you've got to wait till they wake up, until they're available, and until they clock in. And as soon as it's a committee, it will never happen. And therefore, he says to Haman, I want you to do everything. And again, for Achashverosh, he's convinced that Haman will be only too pleased to do everything personally for Mordechai, because that's his goal in life, at least for the time being, is to see that Mordechai gets his reward. And so it is. Now, where does Haman find Mordechai? There's a fascinating medrash here, and it just serves to remind us where we are in the Jewish year. Most of the critical happening moments of the Purim story happened on Pesach, because it was in the month of Nisan that the edict went out. Esther's three-day fast took them into Pesach itself. They didn't eat matzah that year. They overrode everything, pikuach nefesh, and this actually is the third day of the fast. It's the second day of Pesach, and what is Mordechai doing? Mordechai is sitting, and he's teaching Torah to children. And what are they learning? They're learning about the Korban Omer. Because that's in Yonah Diyoma. This is them in Persia remembering what happened when the Beis Hamikdash was standing on the second day of Pesach, Mimachor Shabbos, on the second day of Pesach, they would bring a Korban Omer. So here is Mordechai teaching the halachas of the Omer to his young students. And Haman arrives, and he's there to take Mordechai and to get him ready. But he waits. He waits till they finish, and then he asks the children, "What were you learning?" So they told him, "When the Beis Hamikdash was here, they used to bring a korban omer, and then they would take a fistful of the barley." And Haman, at this stage, already realizes that things are unraveling, as far as he's concerned. And the way that the Medrash describes it is that he says to these children, "You know, your fistful of barley seems to be more significant and be carrying more weight than all the money that I offered Achashverosh, because Mordechai is beginning to win and I'm beginning to lose. So I don't know what your secret is in this Omer that you're talking about, but it's got a lot of power to it." And the Maharal, in his Sefer Or Chodosh on Megillas Esther, explains there's a deeper point here, that how it comes to be that the turning point for Haman is the day of the bringing of the Omer. As we've seen, Haman knows quite well how the natural world works in terms of the forces at play. He knows the world of mazalos. His lottery is based on mazalos, right? He knows when is the worst time for the Jewish people. He's aware that the Jewish people have a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But as far as he's concerned, it is only in the realms of open miracles, which means they're either there or there's no connection at all. That relates to our discussion of a few weeks ago. He's happy when he came to the month that Moshe Rabbeinu died, because the death of Moshe Rabbeinu is the end of that type of open miracle relationship. It's a very propitious time for Haman, because without those open miracles, there's no connection. What he doesn't realize is that even within the world of mazalos, Hashem maneuvers them and stays connected and arranges things for the success of the Jewish people. And that is represented by the Korban Omer. The reason why the Torah says that the Omer is to be brought on the day, on the second day of Pesach, what it calls Mimachras HaShabbos, is because it is a progression of the concept that begins on the first day of Pesach. There, Pesach day one is open miracles, Yetzias Mitzrayim, all the makos and everything that went with that. But then Mimachras HaShabbos, what's on the morrow? What is a progression of that idea? Is the Omer. The Omer is brought at a key point in the harvest. and it is brought as recognition that ultimately it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who guides the harvest, even though harvest is really natural law. It's agriculture, it's the rainfall, it's the seasons, it's the way things grow. But bringing the Korban Omer on the day after the first day of Pesach is saying that even natural things take their cue and partake of the same connection that we have on the first day. The only difference is one is a revealed connection and one's a concealed connection. But they're both connections. It's not the difference between connected and disconnected. It's just two different types of connection. And that is what Haman is realizing now, is that he thought that left to the world of nature, the Jewish people are not connected to Hashem at all. But he sees that things are beginning to backfire for him a little bit. He came to Ahasuerus's palace hoping to hang Mordechai. And a few hours later, he finds himself with royal garments ready to get Mordechai and parade him through the city. Someone is maneuvering things. That's the fistful of barley. And so he proceeds to get Mordechai ready. And there's a fascinating account of just those moments or that time. Because the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, on Daf Tet Zayin, he comes to Mordechai and says, I've got to parade you through the streets. Here's some royal clothing. But Mordechai has been involved in his sackcloth and his ashes, and he says to Haman, you know, it's not really bechavadik for me to just take all this off and put the king's royal clothing. I haven't had a bath for a while. And Esther, in the meanwhile, had closed down all the local bathhouses, which means Haman himself needs to bathe Mordechai. He's his attendant, and he gets him his whatever he needs. This is not really the way Haman thought this day would go at all. And it hasn't finished yet, because Mordechai says, also I need to shave and to trim up, and I haven't had a haircut in a while. And Esther has closed all of the barbers, and Haman himself was a barber, so he's calling on recalling skills. He thought he would never need them again. He's got to take out his trusty scissors, and there he's giving Mordechai a haircut, and he's just, how did it come to this? And finally, Mordechai has got his royal clothes, and he's all groomed, and he's ready. And Haman says, "Okay, so now on the horse, I'm gonna prepare." And Mordechai says, "You know, this is my third day fasting. I don't have koach. It's hard. It's a high horse. Could you give me a hand?" So Haman has got to crouch down, and Mordechai steps on him as he puts his foot into the stirrup to get onto the horse. And that is pretty much as bad as Haman thought things could get. Little did he know. But it was a really low moment for Haman. And then he parades Mordechai through the streets. Kach yasel isha shehamelech chafetz bikaro. Okay. Then what? So, after this, interestingly, Mordechai just goes back to what he was doing, the way the Pasuk describes it in Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayashav Mordechai al Shar HaMelech. And what about Haman? The Haman nidchafa beso. Haman, he hurries. He hurries home. And the way that he is called is Avel v'chafoi rosh. He's in mourning and his head is covered. Why is he in mourning and what is his head covered with? Well, again, the Gemara gives us some background. Haman had a daughter in addition to all of his sons, and she saw from the roof, everyone came to see this parade, someone is parading someone. Last she heard, the one who's most likely to be honored by the king is her father. If anyone is leading him through the streets, it's going to be his arch nemesis, Mordechai. So she takes all of the sewage from the house, and she throws it on the one who's leading the horse, thinking that it's Mordechai. In fact, it was Haman. He looks up, and then she realizes that it's him, and she throws herself off the roof. And that's why it says Haman hurried home. He's Avel. Now he's mourning because of his daughter. But he's Chafur Rosh. What's his head covered in? It's covered in everything that she threw on him. And that's why he hurries home, because he's not really smelling his normal rosy self. And therefore he just wants to get home and to sort himself out. He's got another feast coming quite soon, as he has a lot of cleaning up to do. And then what happens? So we have Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayisaper Haman, Lezeresh Ishto Ulechol Avav. So he tells to Zeresh, his wife, to all of his friends, Es Kol Asher Kara, everything that happened to him. Vayomer Lo Chachama Vezeresh Ishto. Now his wise men and his wife Zeresh said, Im Mizera Yehudim Mordechai, Asher Echilos in the Pol Lefanav, if Mordechai is descended from the Jews that you have begun to fall before him, Lo Tuchalo, so you'll never best him. Ki Nafol Tibol Lefanav, you will just continue to fall. Now, what's interesting is, what do they mean with these words? Im Mizera Hayehudim. If he's Jewish, the one person in the world that you don't need to wonder if they're Jewish is Mordechai. He's very Jewish. So im mizera, you know if he's Jewish. What's the if? But the point is, and furthermore, if we may ask, these are his wise men. They do not seem to be giving him much counsel. I mean, they seem to be just predicting his downfall. Because they're saying, if he's Jewish, you start to fall, this is never going to end well. You're just going to continue to fall. That's his team. Those are his people. And that's all they have to say to him. It's going to keep on going. Interestingly, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, it says that he said to Zeresh Ishto and all of his friends, Ulechol Ohavav. But as the pasuk continues, it says, "Vayomer Chachama v'Zeresh Ishto," his wise men. Where did his friends go? I think the point is they realize maybe they shouldn't be friends with him anymore. That's the point when they become chachamim. They're very smart. Part of being smart is disassociating themselves from Haman because he is going down, and that's essentially what they say to him. But what is the point? So Yosef Lekach explains. Haman here, really the question is, should he desist from his plans against Mordechai or not? And because he's very determined and very stubborn, as far as Haman is concerned, there's no reason why he shouldn't keep going. He sees today's events as, at most, a temporary setback. And that's why he said, the pasuk says, Vayisaper Haman, the Zeresh Ishto, L'chol Ohavav, Es Kol Asher Kara, everything that happened to him, he's an adherent to the idea that things happen, and therefore, although Mordechai got the best of him here, but that's just how it happened. That's a glitch. That's a random event. It shouldn't stand in the way of him pursuing his program with Mordechai. And that's what he wishes to impress upon the members of his household. But the truth of the matter is, they say to him, that's not true. You're making a mistake. Because what they're saying is, if he's Mizera Yehudim, and he is, and you have started to fall, that means everyone is recognizing that Hashem is very much connected with the Jewish people. Random things like this do not happen to the Jewish people. And this is the beginning of your downfall. In other words, the very same wise men who told him to build a gallows to hang Mordechai, they are still wise in the sense that yesterday, as far as they're concerned, their God has forsaken them. If that's true, Mordechai is easy prey. However, today they've come to realize that their God has not forsaken them. And if that's true, then you're making a mistake. Because what has happened today is the beginning of a process. Their God is connected with them. And if that's true, then it will continue to happen. But their goal here is not to predict his demise. Their goal here is not to consign him to doom. Their goal is to persuade him to back down. As if to say, yesterday we gave you good advice, yesterday's good advice has expired. A new reality has made itself apparent. If you've begun to fall, you will continue to fall. Be aware of that, and that's why we don't want you to fall, which means you've got to desist from this. That's their counsel to him. And they were discussing and debating. And Haman is saying no. And they're saying yes. And the debate continued in Pasuk Yudal, Odom Medabrim Imo. They're still talking, as if to say, not just that they're in mid-sentence from the words Nafalti Pol. They were talking for a while because Haman is remonstrating with them and he's arguing. He's saying, no, it's just a random thing. And saying, no, it's not true. And in fact, a lot of the conversation came out. And so much so, Sarisei HaMelech Higiu, the king's courtiers, they came, Vayavhiru Lavias Haman, and they hurried to bring Haman, Ela Mishteh Asher Asusa Esther, to the feast that Esther had made, to the second feast. It's not clear whether Haman ever even had a chance to clean up before he was hurried to the second feast. But it is interesting that these sarissim, they, because there's a lot of arguing going on between Haman and his people, says the Malbim, explains that's how they became privy to certain information about what Haman is doing. We find in the next parak that Harvona, when things are getting even worse for Haman, and Harvona says, look, there's the gallows that Haman built, Gavah HaMishim Amah, he built it to hang Mordechai. How does Harvona know this? Well, we have a Kabbalah that Harvona is Eliyahu. If he's Eliyahu, so then there's no question, so Eliyahu knows. But if it's Harvona, so then he's just one of the king's people. How does he know what Haman's been doing? Because Haman and his family were discussing this when the king's people came to take him away. So they overheard him saying, no, I can still hang Haman, I built the gallows, etc. They overheard that information, which then worked backfires for Haman. And that's how the parak ends. What's very interesting is that from a certain point of view, the story of the Megillah, it's a long time in getting ready. I mean, the whole thing from beginning to end took place over something like 12 years. And Esther is queen for a good long while before anything happens. And from the feast until Haman's decree is a good long while. But then, when things begin to happen, they happen very quickly. We have this element, as soon as things turn, things move very swiftly. And therefore, it's within just one or two days, everything is already been arranged. And you have Achashverosh saying to Haman, Maher, hurry, be quick, take Mordechai. And then before Haman's able to get himself together via Filu, they hurry him. And as the Maharal points out, this is a certain quality that actually has a precedent within the first of our geulas, namely Yetzias Mitzrayim, where we say Ki v'chi pozon yotzasa mi'eretz Mitzrayim. And as we know, and we've discussed in the past, the aspect of chipozon is of hurrying is very central to Pesach. So much so that the mitzvah of matzah, the way the pasuk describes it, is in order to commemorate the fact that we left so quickly, bebehala. In fact, the Aramaic, Unkelus' translation of the word chipazon is behilu, from the word behala. It's the same concept. And that becomes now embedded in the central mitzvah of matzah. But the question is, why is behala so important? Why is it such a central concept within Geula, within Geulas Mitzrayim, and then we come to see within the Geula of in the story of Purim? And the Maharal explains in his way that ultimately what Geula represents is HaKadosh Baruch Hu drawing the Jewish people towards him. He is asserting their connectedness with him. Well, as we know, as much as it's impossible to fully fathom what it means, but we know it as such, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not exist within time. And time itself is something that he created, which means that with something which takes time, it's already part of the created world. Something that happens in no time at all already is in a much more transcendent and elevated and godly way. And therefore, because the redemption from Mitzrayim was the beginning of our connection with Hashem, so the connection partook of that transcendent quality, and that's why it was of the essence that we left Mitzrayim so quickly. We left Mitzrayim in no time at all because we're connected to an entity that is above time. And that's why matzah becomes such a central part of Pesach, because it reflects and expresses the uniqueness of the Jewish people. That's why the consequences of eating chametz are so severe. Essentially, chametz is matzah plus time. And the same is true in a somewhat adapted way, says Maharal, the same is true with regards to Purim. On the one hand, Purim is a hidden miracle. And therefore, it takes a while for things to assemble, a number of years. But when the time comes for Geula to strike, it happens quickly. Because at the moment of Geula, once again, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu asserting his connection with Bnei Yisrael, and he is above time, and therefore things happen quickly, and things are rushed, and Haman's made to hurry, and then they hurry to get him, and that's the element of Behala. Interestingly, the chapter of Tehillim, which is very closely associated with the story of Purim, is Ayeles HaShachar. Now, Ayeles HaShachar, which is the Tehillim Perikav base, in fact, here in Yerushalayim, where they follow the minhag of the Gra in many things, according to whom, whenever there's a special day, So the normal Shir Shayom is put aside, and it's like a special Shir Shayom for all the Yomim Tovim and the Yomim Narayim, and also on Purim. The Shir Shayom for Purim morning, according to the minhag of the Vilna Gaon, which is followed by many places here in Yerushalayim, is Tehillim Kaf Beis Lamnatzer Al Ayeles HaShachar. And what does Ayeles HaShachar mean? Well, the Gemara in Maseches Yuma Daf Kaf Tes explains Ayeles HaShachar as a reference to the morning star. The way the Gemara expresses it is that just like the morning star represents the end of a certain time frame, so too Esther was the end of a certain time frame. It's the end of the night. Esther was the end of all miracles, or open miracles, certainly, the way the Gemara expresses it. But others explain that Ayeles HaShachar is like from the word Ayala, which is a deer, or that type of wild animal. And somehow, therefore, the Purim story is associated with this deer. But why? So the Maharal says, you know, the way that a deer moves, essentially, is that it can be somewhere for a while, but when it moves, it jumps. And then it can stay stationary for another long while, and then it jumps again. And that reflects the nature of the miracle of Purim, whereby things, for a long while, nothing seemed to be happening. They were somewhat stationary. And then Esther's the queen, and they've done what they've done. They've gone to Ahasuerus' feast. It was a good long while ago. She's been queen for a number of years, and there are things that are almost like crouching, but then they jump. And within 2 days, everything changes, and that is the nature of Ayeles HaShachar. And therefore, one finds the blend that on the one hand, there are certain things that take time, but then when things happen, they happen quickly. That's the nature of the miracle of Purim, which brings it back to the miracle of Pesach. And once again, this reinforces the connection between those two. As we know, and we mentioned a few weeks ago, in a year such as this, a leap year where there's two Adars, strictly speaking, in pure terms, both Adars are Adar. And therefore, there could be room to argue that Purim should be in first Adar, not to forego an opportunity to do a mitzvah. And yet, we don't say that. Rather, we delay it. Other things are in the first Adar, but we delay Purim to the second Adar. Why? Says the Gemara in Megillah, in order to link the redemption of Purim to Chodesh Nisan, the redemption of Mitzrayim. Mesmach Geula LeGeula, to juxtapose redemption with redemption. And as the Bnei Yisachar points out, it's not just a question of, well, in Pesach we're redeemed, and in Purim we're redeemed. The two are juxtaposed in order to show that they are similar to each other. They partake of the same quality for the very same reason. One shouldn't think that the message of Pesach is about open miracles, and if it's not an open miracle, it has nothing to do with Pesach. That's not true. As the Ramban states in the end of Parshas Bo, the full message And the full meaning of the open miracles of Pesach is in order for the Jewish people to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved in the world, but they then need to extend that concept and realize that Hashem is involved with the natural destiny of the Jewish people. From a certain point of view, it's fair to say that the reason why the redemption of Purim is juxtaposed to Pesach is because it is a day like Purim that does full justice to the miracles of Pesach. Those miracles were done in order for the Jewish people to realize that Hashem is in charge of their natural goings-on. No, that is not expressed in anywhere more poignantly than in the Purim story, and therefore we link the two together because, in a sense, Purim, I could almost say, is the completion of the message of Pesach, and therefore it is only to be expected and most apropos that it partakes also of the qualities of the Geula of Pesach, including B'Challah, and therefore Haman is hurried to the second feast of Esther. That brings our discussion of the Megillah for this year to a close. Of course, no need to wait to find out what happens. Purim will be in just a few days, but we'll leave it over there for this evening.